So thank you very much, Alistair. I'm absolutely delighted to be here and to be able to share the insights that I learned from this process with you all. And I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this country. I guess this was a very tense time for both Alistair and myself, because we never knew until Wednesday afternoon. In fact, I didn't find out till 10:30 p.m. last Wednesday that the minister was going to release the report. I think we feared, that it might be quietly buried as part of the caretaker period in these fairly turbulent political times. But the minister did release the report, and that actually made it rather easier for me to talk today, because I really was rather scared about what I was going to be able to say if the minister hadn't released the report. So my emphasis today is really going to be about my vision for an Australian doctorate for the 21st century, and it's very much informed by the report process. So, as Alistair said, the ACOLA is the Australian Council of Learned Academies, and they were given the gig to do this report as part of a series of documents called the SAF Reviews, Securing Australia's Future, and this was SAF 13. And there was an expert working group made up of members of the four academies. All the members of the expert working group had a university background, except for the chair, John McGar, who had been head of research and innovation at Rio Tinto, and he brought a very different perspective to the issue from the rest of us. We got 85 submissions, we conducted 6 public fora, and many of the people here would have been there. We did specialist forums with the Australian Council of Graduate Research and the DVCSR, and we conducted 84 interviews. So we heard a lot. As was pointed out by Denise Cuspid in her op-ed piece in The Australian yesterday, we actually heard a lot from the academy, and it was really hard to get industry, which government wanted us, and I'm using industry in the broad sense here, to engage. In fact, John McGar would be ringing up his pals in various companies and saying, please put in a submission, please come and be interviewed, and largely they didn't respond even to his personal invitations, and I think that does reflect a problem. So the government, in its wisdom, decided on 2 reviews simultaneously. The Watt Review, which talked about the broader financing issues relating to research, all aspects of research in higher education in Australia, and the ACOLA Review, which was about research training, and I actually agree with James that I like the word research education much better. Quality. Now, I think actually, because there were those 2 reviews with very separate terms of reference, and there was a lot of communication, particularly between the chairs, but I actually think some quite important issues completely fell between the cracks. And the most significant of those, which is still on the table but has not been discussed, is the opportunity for universities to charge low fees for domestic students. And nobody talked about it. And we discovered on Monday at the Australian Council for Graduate Research, I like D-dogs much better, and I'm the oldest dog, D-dog of all, that matter was still on the table, and I think it's an opportunity missed that we haven't had the chance to debate it. So the ACOLA review had 3 pillars: the person, We wanted to focus on that Australian research training produces high quality researchers capable of succeeding in different sectors. Was the nation getting its good return on investment? Was our investment in research education contributing to the future prosperity of the nation, and then in the system that underpins that? And as was pointed out by James yesterday, the most important component of that is the person. So I wanted to start by illustrating the diversity of our research education candidate population by giving you a few personal snapshots. So this is Chris, and Chris is 23, he's Australian, he's brilliant, he's got a university medal, he's studying pure research in English literature. Putu Lisa is 35, she's a veterinarian, she's been sent here by the Indonesian government to get doctoral qualifications so she can go back and be part of the Indonesian Academy. Felicia is one of the rare Indigenous researchers that we have doing doctoral education, doctoral training in Australia. She's a Torres Strait Islander. She's been a principal of a remote school, and she wants to get a PhD because she wants to contribute to education policy. Milena is 28. She's an Australian. She was a physiotherapy graduate. She's worked in clinical practice, but she wants to take part in innovation. Yasif is 44. He's from Pakistan, and he's doing engineering as a way of a new life. These are very, very different people. They're coming to research education with very different backgrounds, very different skills, and any reform to our system has to consider this sort of diversity, which is very challenging. So if we look at what's happened since the mid-80s, there's been a huge increase in numbers in our system, and particularly since 2000. Most candidates are studying doctorates. In fact, since 2000, the number of candidates studying research masters has decreased in absolute as well as relative terms. The other big change that has happened is there's been a vast increase in international research candidates. And so domestic enrolments have flattened out, and the increase has largely been through international enrolments. And Australia's not the only country in which this is true. I think it's really fascinating to look at the fields of education of these international candidates, and you'll see that they are dominating training or education in some fields, particularly engineering and related technologies. In this graph, I have colour-coded the STEM disciplines in beige and the humanities and social sciences in grey. And you can see that overwhelmingly, with apart from management and commerce, this vast importance of international students has come in the STEM disciplines in Australia. Two-thirds of our candidates are over 30. In fact, the median start age is well into the 30s. This comes as a surprise. It was very interesting that even some of the deputy vice chancellors on our expert review panel for ECOLA were amazed at this statistic. They were seeing this through the lens of their own experience. And in one case, a really respected deputy vice chancellor from a major research university said, "I can't believe these numbers. I thought that they were all 23. Because in his discipline, they are. We also were charged with looking at candidates from non-traditional backgrounds. Now, in this graph, there are two halves, and the above the line means that candidates are overrepresented relative to their proportion in the general population. Remember, these are domestic candidates only. And below the line is underrepresented. Obviously, candidates from non-English-speaking backgrounds are very well represented in our population. Most of the other groups are underrepresented, and I want to bring particular attention to Indigenous participation, which is low and declining. And I have to say that the ECOLA Review's emphasis on candidates from non-traditional backgrounds was really about Indigenous participation, because that's the aspect that everyone wanted to talk about. And so I think we have underdone the other groups. Employment status is very good, but the question is, are our doctoral candidates underutilised in our innovation economy? And we don't know the answer to that question, because the data are terrible. Now, here we have an audience of people who do research into research education, but actually, sorry guys, there's not a lot of data at the scale required to inform policy. And more about that. People don't do a doctorate for the money. We know that. So yes, having a research higher degree has a very slight salary advantage over a coursework postgraduate degree, but it's absolutely marginal. The other thing that's very interesting is everyone says, and Professor Beddington said this, and I'm certainly not disagreeing, that most doctoral graduates are not now working in the academy, but actually getting that data is very difficult. So we go back to the Australian Census, and it says that only 25% of people with doctorates, and that includes the whole population in terms of age, so it's not just new doctorates, report their occupation as tertiary teachers. When you go back to the census form, you actually realise this is rather a difficult source of information, because it's a free form text. And I talked to some of my colleagues and I said, you know, how do you fill in this? And I got some extraordinary answers. One guy who's an associate professor said, well, I write turtle biologist. So I think these aren't great data. And this is the preoccupation of the Australian government. Now, Australia never likes coming last, right? We applaud gold medalists and we forget about everybody else. But there are now many indicators that indicate we have a very poor knowledge transfer between university research and industry. The blame is largely placed on university researchers. The accusation is that we can't communicate. I actually think that's really wrong. I think we've come a very long way. I've been very engaged in applied stakeholder-driven research now for nearly 30 years, but it's really hard to get industry engaged. And that kind of response is a bit too common. But this is the issue of greatest concern to government. So what I've done is I've prepared a Helene report card. This has no standing whatsoever, on four domains, and where I think we are and where I'd like us to be. So internationally competitive. I think we do pretty well about the thesis, the research, and our reputation is clearly good. We have lots of international students coming. 50% of our theses are examined by international examiners. 95% of them recommend pass. But I'm not sure that we're as internationally competitive for the doctorate as a whole, as opposed to the research, as we need to be. How candidate-centred is our doctoral education? Well, the data that James gave yesterday would suggest not very. If you go and look at the PREC returns, you could feel smug and say, well, 86% of people that responded were satisfied or very satisfied. But remember, that's only about graduates. And what about the 30% that drop out? And I doubt that they would have found their experience very satisfactory. So I give us a kind of a medium low mark there. Evidence-based, sorry guys, it isn't. We really struggled to get the evidence to inform national policy. Industry engaged, big question mark. Clearly there are some indicators that would suggest that there is a real problem between our research and industry engagement, and I'm using a very inclusive definition for industry. Margaret Kiley tells me it's the wrong word, and I challenge you to come up with a better one. That, you know, for some of us, industry means holes in the ground and making stuff, whereas here I'm talking very generally. So how industry engaged would we like to be? Well, I really respect the Vice Chancellor's comment that we actually do want our doctoral candidates to be engaged in discovery research. So I think we can move a bit there, but we don't want to go the whole hog where everybody is doing applied research. I think we need to increase, and the ECOLA review really stressed this, our international competitiveness with a new pathway degree. And we're really struggling here because of the rules and the constraints placed by government. So we don't have an internationally recognised entry pathway to research education. Increasingly, people are seeing this in terms of the Bologna cycles, where the first 3 years is the bachelor's degree, 2 years master's, 3 years doctorates. Even in the American system is looking to that model. In Australia, the most traditional entry pathway is the honours degree, which is an undergraduate degree in the cycle. Okay, less than half of our candidates for doctorates are coming into that route, but they're doing they're using routes that are not necessarily internationally accepted, such as postgraduate diplomas and things like that. I really realised we had a problem when I was told that the University of Oxford considers that our best and our brightest, our Rhodes Scholars, are inadequately prepared for doctoral education. So we talked about this to many of you, and in general, people supported a research training coursework master's. There was an acknowledgement that the Macquarie model was a very brave new attempt at a new pathway, but it would break the research training scheme if it were adopted more generically, because the research training scheme is a fixed bucket of money and it's divided by completions, and suddenly if we have a huge increase in masters by research completions, we'll be devaluing the money for the doctorate. So there's a lot of work to be done here and a lot of discussion with government as to whether they are prepared to change the regulations to enable a student affordable research training coursework master's degree or some other recognised master's degree that will enable our candidates to have an internationally competitive entry pathway. We also felt there needed to be a lot of international benchmarking at a disciplinary level. So often universities are quite smug about the quality of their doctorate because the thesis is considered very good. However, we heard repeatedly that our graduates in many disciplines, I used marine science because it's close to home for me, but it needed advanced skills training in quantitative and qualitative methods, and they needed to be able to handle big data. And we heard it from people, that's the director of Australian Institute of Marine Science, we heard it from biomedical people, we heard it from educationists, we heard it from social sciences, that we're lacking here. And one of my fellow deans said, well, if we did some more benchmarking, I hope that the senior academics could be convinced that we have a bit of a problem here. We felt that we really needed to be upfront with prospective candidates about their career prospects. They needed to know that actually the likelihood of their ending up as academics is quite low, but there are all sorts of exciting career opportunities available to them. In general, prospective candidates do not know this, and often academics advise them that the only real career, if they're going to be successful, is in academia, and that was mentioned earlier. So we need to be much more upfront. We need to excite candidates about a range of career options and equip them to do it. There is going to be deregulation of government scholarships from 2017. It is going to purportedly designed to enable universities to better align the candidate needs with the candidature realities. At the moment, we have a mismatch in the timing. I have to say that, like James, I was not sanguine about the information that we got at the DDoGS meeting on Monday. And the reality is going to be that if universities are going to fund candidates better for longer, there isn't going to be any new money and there's going to be fewer scholarships. And given that most of us have the regulations for our university scholarships mirroring the regulations for government scholarships, actually, I think this is going to be quite a dilemma for everyone. So I welcome the reform, but it would be nice that there was some more money that went with it, but there won't be. I think we need to improve our transferable skills training. Now, the report acknowledges that many universities, most universities, have, I think, bravely invested in transferable skills training, despite the fact that we haven't had the injection of money that happened in the UK with the Roberts money or EU countries. So we've battled to achieve this, but I think because we haven't had the injection of money, and I don't think we're going to, that transferable skills training is not as deeply embedded in the Australian doctorate as it is in many other countries. I also think that we need to increase, and the report says this, emphasis on career development as opposed to skills required to finish the thesis, which we're better at. I note that in some other countries, particularly Canada, which I'm going to talk a lot about later, this actually industry itself is very much engaged in the career development of doctoral candidates. And we need accessible evidence of the transferable skills of our candidates, because the problem is most of them don't know the skills they've got. And employers don't know either. And if the candidates don't know and they can't transmit it to employers, we have a problem, because our graduates have a lot of amazing skills. Problem-solving skills, problem-identifying skills, writing skills, etc., analysis skills, software skills, etc. We noted that the Australian Higher Education Graduation Statement actually has a place where you can put this information. But in Australia, we lack an accepted typology for identifying the various skills domains and a way of transmitting this evidence easily. Many universities are having electronic backpacks or e-portfolios where candidates can collect their evidence of their skills training, but how many employers are going to read an e-portfolio? We need a way of transmitting this information in a way that employers trust. And we need to professionalise supervision. All the research shows that good supervision is the most important contributor to research education success. Most universities now require supervision training for new supervisors. Very few of us have compulsory ongoing professional development. Many universities have supervision, at least notionally, included in performance management and in promotion. But how many people have an accepted way of actually judging this? How many people have really robust workload criteria for supervision, particularly team supervision that is now mandatory across Australian universities? We know that there are bad practices still exist. By cloning, I'm meaning that the advisor assumes that the candidate wants to be them when they grow up. Sometimes they've grown up and they're actually older than their supervisor. And we know that too many supervisors still see their candidates as cheap labour, and neither of these things is a professional practice. We know that we have to change the supervisor culture. Now, it's very interesting, if you read the review of the Roberts initiatives in the UK, and we interviewed Professor Alison Hodges, who was the head of that review panel, and she said, you know, we did a good job on the students, but we forgot about the supervisors. And we forgot to convince them that there was a new world out there and that research training in skills is really important. And then most universities actually find it really hard. Oh, what have I done? Sorry. To deal with the silverbacks. In fact, I'll tell you a story. In this room, I have Liz Tynan, who's the academic skills coordinator at the graduate school at JCU. And she was told by one of these silverbacks that our compulsory skills training that in critical thinking and writing that we have for all international students was doing his students harm because it was taking them away from the bench. That's truly shocking, but we really find dealing with these people very hard, and I think that's true of all universities. There are eminent researchers who are actually not very professional about their supervisory practices. And going back, we need to increase the number of and our support for our Indigenous doctoral candidates. Indigenous researchers have much to offer our nation. There's a lot discussed about closing the gap. Part of this is that we need Indigenous researchers informing policy on the problem. We spoke to many wonderful Indigenous people who are taking leading roles in Australian universities. They were very clear. You must talk about an additive model, not a deficit model. We think, the COLA panel was absolutely convinced, we need hard targets for Indigenous participation in research education in Australia. A very strong signal would be sent to the Australian university community if we did as we do, as New Zealand does, and weight Indigenous completions at twice everybody else's completions. Actually, that's not going to make much of a difference to the amount of money that universities spend in this area, but it would be a very, very strong signal. But it wouldn't do much for the Indigenous candidate necessarily, and we need to think about them very hard. So we believed, ACOLA, that there needed to be incentives to increase Indigenous participation. Deregulation of scholarships is going to enable universities to give higher value scholarships, but most of us already do this. We called for an Indigenous fellowship program where at least some Indigenous candidates were treated as professionals within the university setting, much in the way that doctoral candidates are treated in Scandinavian universities. But there are other ways that we must do better. So this top graph, these are dreadful figures. These are the blue line is commencing candidates, and it's a proportion of the overall, and the red line is completing candidates. So you can see that the completion rate of doctoral Indigenous candidates is lower than the rest of the population. We need to ensure that they have a very positive, supportive university environment, and we need to include culturally appropriate supervisory training for the supervisors of Indigenous candidates. And then we get the best question of industry engagement. So the review calls for a higher proportion of doctoral education could be focused on external problems, take place in external settings, involve a non-academic supervisor. Now, I know a lot of that happens now, but there's no data. And this is a real problem. And of course, funding is needed to drive change. This isn't just going to happen because the government thinks it's a good idea. And as I said earlier, and has been pointed out by others, it's not just a university problem. Somehow we have to get industry in the broad sense to the table. And I think Denise Cuthbert summed this up very well in her op-ed piece in The Australian yesterday, and I commend it to you. So somehow we have to get them engaged. So I want to talk to you now about what I learned about one similar country to ours, Canada, is doing about this problem. It's only one example, but I think it's a very salutary one. So I went to visit MITACS, which is the agency charged with industry engagement, for fostering industry engagement between the academy and industry in the broad sense in Canada. I went there because at the recommendation of Barbara Evans, who many of you know. She used to be the dean at the University of Melbourne, and then she went to UBC for 5 years. And she said, "Helene, check it out. It would work really well in Australia." So I was in San Francisco for a completely other reason, and I persuaded Akola to fund me to go to Vancouver for the day. It was a long day. It started at 4 a.m., and I got back to my hotel at midnight. But it completely transformed my view of the sorts of things that we could do. So, yes, we do have some internship programs in Australia. I estimate that fewer than 120 Australian doctoral candidates did interns, I'm not talking about JRE cadetships, last year. So AMSI, the Australian Mathematical Science Institute, does about 100 placements a year. IPREC, which is an initiative of the Western Australian universities, very commendable, but very low numbers. Advanced Queensland, which is the state government department for science and innovation, had launched a program last year, and I think this is really indicative of the problem in Australia. So they got 38 industries throughout the state to engage and offer placements. They went out to the universities, and guess how many applications they got? 18. And then how many actually translated into real placements? 7. I said to my lab group, "Well, what do you think, how many people do you think would have applied? They said, "None." And I said, well, what are the barriers? And they said, well, Helene, you're always banging on about completions and getting our thesis in on time. We weren't going to get any new scholarship, so why would we ever apply? They said they were amazed that 18 people applied. And actually, of the 7 placements, 2 were from JCU, which is quite a small university, so it wasn't that we didn't advertise it. The Watt Review recommended 700 industry placements funded by 6 months extra on APAs be awarded to universities according to the RTS formula. When we talked to the Ocola Review panel, talked to the Watt Review people and the people from the Department of Education, and we said, well, we don't think this is going to work. And they said, yes, well, we do admit there wasn't a lot of thought put into that recommendation. We were much more interested in the formula. So let's look at Canada. A Canadian research candidate at the moment is 16 times more likely to do an internship than their Australian counterpart. These are scaled figures. If MITAX gets its ambition, by 2020, if we do nothing, a Canadian candidate will be nearly 50 times more likely to do an internship. And 79% of those internships are with small and medium enterprises, which are of greatest concern to government. Small and medium enterprises often mostly don't have the money to engage in large-scale research projects. However, using a MITAX-type formula, actually they can engage for a very small investment. So this is how it works. The basic building block for a MITAX program requires an academic, an industry collaborator, a student, a problem translated into a proposal. It goes into MITAX. MITAX has a look at it and makes sure it isn't about slavery and there is a real problem. They send it out to a referee, and 92% of cases, the money is there in 6 weeks. Now, our Prime Minister loves nimble. This is pretty nimble. And that's for a 4 month internship, and the industry partner contributes half of the money. But it's quite a small amount of money, and an SME can easily find that kind of money. So, last year, they had nearly 3,200 interns. You can see they spanned a range of areas. Social science and humanities and arts are still underrepresented. They have expanded it now to include NGOs. They don't include government because it's underwritten by the federal government and every provincial government in Canada. And so they think it's double dipping to put the interns back into government. I have to say the Ocola expert working group felt we needn't have that scruple. We were happy if we could have a program that involved government. The interns have been surveyed. Most feel extra employable as a result of their internship. And these are the sorts of things that industry says. So this is a survey done by MITAX of 200 companies. 92% said they'd recommend the program. 66% said the project results have been or will be commercialised. 36% saw the prospect of new or enhanced product development. 30% had hired the intern. 47% said they were engaged in new collaborations, and 80% continued collaborations. This all started in 2003 with 17 interns. Now there are second generations. There are people who were MITAX interns who've gone out into industry who are having MITAX interns. It's a pretty different situation than in Australia. And lastly, we need to improve our evidence base. As I told you, we couldn't estimate the return on the about $1 billion and getting smaller government investment in research education in Australia. We didn't have the data on how to improve the system at a policy level. We need longitudinal data sets on our graduate outcomes. This would be able to drive performance but also inform candidates. New Zealand is putting us to shame here. They have a large-scale longitudinal survey, and we need to look at that. A plenary speaker at the DDoGs on Monday from the US was saying they needed this sort of data. They also said perfect was the enemy of good and that they might have to settle for a set of cross-sectional studies. I don't know where. I hope we can do longitudinal studies in Australia. It would be much easier than in the US, but we certainly need data. So let's go back to our Australian doctorate for the 21st century. I'd like us to be getting 100% A+ on internationally competitive for the doctoral education, not just the thesis. I would like our program to be more candidate-centred. We mightn't want to get 100%. We do have a bit of QA here that was required, and maybe if it's totally candidate-centred, that could suffer. Evidence-based, absolutely. And industry-engaged, certainly we want to have a very large place for discovery research, but we do need to be better industry-engaged than we are now. And let's go back to our candidates in 5 years hence. So Chris, the pure researcher, has his postdoc at Oxford, which we hope will underpin a stellar academic career. Pete Uluza is on the faculty of Bogar Agricultural University, returning the benefits to her country. Felicia, at 45, is the Director of Indigenous Education for the Queensland Government and transforming the policy in that area. Milena is now working for a start-up medical device company in Melbourne. And Yassif has a new career as a solar energy engineer with a multinational in Sydney. All of these people are contributing to the knowledge economy of their countries. So, I see doctoral education as an investment in human capital for the knowledge economy. We need to be more concerned about the people as well as the papers. Thank you.